Matt, thank you very much. And it's, for me, it's really a pleasure to be here. I can see so many of my friends and people I have admired for many years who are here tonight. At the end of yesterday's plenary session, I caught the gist of an argument over whether the great crisis that reached its boiling point in 2008-2009 was financial, whether it was something deeper, namely structural. And there were also interesting allusions to the role of imbalances and a pointed question about the place of fraud in the larger picture. And I want to touch on all of these issues this evening, but also to place them in what I hope will be something approaching a coherent setting. So just to begin, that discussion yesterday seemed to me to call attention to the need to be careful about the meaning of words and to be alert to the fact that they don't always mean the same thing to different people. For instance, are structural and financial two distinct things? Is there a real economy and a financial economy? I think any careful reader of Minsky, not to mention Davidson, would say not. I will argue a little later on that one deeply structural aspect of the situation we now face is the breakdown of finance, the breakdown in specifically of financial institutions. Let's also consider this word crisis. That too tends, particularly if you consider it casually, to convey a certain set of notions. I think the notion in particular of a temporally limited sequence of events, something that happens and then is over. A shock, perhaps. The two things are not, in fact, close synonyms, but they can be, I think, conflated in many people's minds. That is to say, a shock to a previously not in crisis system. And I think if you take that perspective on the concept of crisis, then you will fall into a pattern of thinking which characterizes most of the work of interpretation that has been offered up by economists so far on the events of 5, 6, and 7 years ago. What we have, I think, by and large, not I think in every case, but in practically all of them, is a panoply of what I call one-note narratives. That is a single-themed essential causes of the crisis. And one of the things I do at in the early pages of this new book, The End of Normal, is to lay out for the reader a number of those one-note narratives. There is, for example, the black swan view. The black swan view holds that, well, bad things happen occasionally, and therefore, while one can't predict them in their specific occurrence, they don't give us any new information about the nature of the system or any particular guidance on what needs to be changed. Black swans, of course, the concept is that they are very rare. There is a modification of that view, or an alternative, which we'll call the fat tails hypothesis, which holds that bad things happen, but actually quite a bit more frequently than one might expect under the black swan's view. But still, even under the fat tails hypothesis, the expected value of change in any given time is zero. You know, events can happen on either tail of the distribution. And although disasters happen frequently, the fat tails hypothesis gives you no comfort that you can effectively change or reform the system, and no particular policy guidance. Moving along into the domain of policy economics, there was a very clear articulation of a causal force behind this crisis in the dissenting views of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission report, particularly the views of Mr. Peter Wallison, who held that the crisis was caused by government having interfered in the otherwise exemplary functioning of the free market by the well-intentioned but foolish desire to put poor people into houses that they owned, and that this was therefore the product of the policy of Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and the Department of Housing and Urban Development operating under the Community Reinvestment Act of 1977, a long and variable lag, admittedly, between 1977 and 2007, but nevertheless, at least within a certain theoretical framework, an entirely coherent view. There is also the view that inequality did it, a view which has a lot more superficial attractiveness to people on the progressive side of the political spectrum, that was articulated in particular by a Chicago Business School professor, now the governor of the Reserve Bank of India, Raghuram Rajan, in his book Fault Lines. And the characteristic aspect of Rajan's view was that inequality, the gap between the poor and the rich, infused the poor with an unsavory degree of envy, which they then expressed by going to their banks and demanding and receiving loans in order to enhance their consumption standards and make their lives more like the ones that they could observe on television or read in the celebrity magazines. And the government accommodated these people foolishly in its desire to win their votes. A very interesting story in which inequality appears almost in a cursory way at the beginning, and another institutional actor that you might think relevant, namely banks, does not appear at all. Then there is the view articulated very forcefully by a very close friend of mine and a member of the faculty of this great institution, Bill Black, which is that fraud did it, that the financial institutions were taken over essentially by criminal cabals, and that they engineered their own destruction in a process of looting. And that view is, of course, true. And the question about it is whether it's embedded in a sufficiently rich explanatory framework. What enabled the fraud? Why did it come about when it did? Were there larger conditions that make some episodes in history more fraudulent than others? I know that last night one of the participants in the panel said that fraud was not very important. Well, sorry, it was. I have listed these various views, therefore, in ascending order of usefulness and correspondence to fact. But it still seems to me that all monocausal explanations are a bit too easy. They suggest that in the absence of specific causal forces or impetus, the crisis would not have happened. that you could simply remove something, remove the inequality, control the fraud, and that things would have gone on as before. And that strikes me as a view which is at least open to question. So we should turn to ways of thinking in which crisis is an endemic or at least a latent feature of the system. And these include the perspective of Marxian economist, which has much to commend it, but which leaves open the question as to why there are ever periods when the system is not in crisis. And I think it's also true that the specific advance warnings of the Marxians were by and large focused on a type of crisis, namely of the dollar and the imperial system, that didn't actually happen on this occasion. Closer to the hearts of this audience, and with distinguished representatives of these points of view sprinkled in the front rows here, I'm going to try to be quite careful. There are two important schools that I identify in the book as the backwater prophets. That is to say, economics is divided between the freshwater, the saltwater, and the backwater. The point, and I appeal to the trained biologist in the room, Professor Davidson, for verification on this. The point that I allege is that a biologist will tell you that both saltwater and freshwater are comparatively sterile, and that in the backwater is where evolution actually occurs. He confirms this view. I take that to the bank. But there were two principal backwater positions. One of them is associated with Wynne Godley and with the Levy Institute teams that have followed in Wynne's tradition, and emphasizes unsustainable trends, imbalances, and Stein's law. Herb Stein, Richard Nixon's chief economic advisor, who famously said, "When a trend cannot continue, it will stop." Godleyan, and I use that word, it always reminds me that godliness was next to Keynesliness, stock flow consistent models are, I think, clearly a major advance. But they still leave open the question of what unsustainable actually means, whether specific balances have to revert to zero in the long run. In a world where the limits, let's say, on the People's Bank of China's accumulation of balances in the securities account, U.S. Treasury bonds and bills, remains essentially opaque and is therefore subject to the decision-making of one very large actor whose motives are not fully known or completely predictable. And I think a similar observation can be made about this question of imbalances in Europe. It baffles me why ex ante one should expect, or why it should be necessary for the 27 members of the European Union, or whatever the number is of the Eurozone, to achieve over any finite period of time a balance in their external accounts. And in fact, no such requirement is imposed upon American states, and the accounts are not even kept. The issue there is not, therefore, whether imbalances have to be removed, but whether there are ways of coping with the fact that they will never be removed, whether there are ways of getting around the institutional and policy conditions that make them matter. And then there is the Minsky view, other great post-Keynesian tradition represented here, with its implicit nonlinear dynamics, beautifully developed by Barclay Rosser, who will be here late tonight and tomorrow, and with its phase transitions, that is to say, systems that within their own structure have the capacity to move from one state to the next, as water does from steam to liquid to ice. Right? And this is, of course, Minsky's hedge, speculative, and Ponzi phases. to which I would add a fourth phase derived from William K. Black and from Akerlof and Romer, namely looting. Right? Seems to me, Minsky didn't develop this, and for Minsky, the Ponzi phase, although it has this evocative frisson of association with one of the great crooks of all time, is not necessarily a criminal one. It is something that you slip into in transition from the speculative phase, perhaps without even realizing it. But looting is the rational insider's reaction to the Ponzi state. Right? It's what the Soviets brilliantly called nomenklatura privatization. It is the stripping of capital assets, financial or non-financial assets, in a situation where you recognize that the debt structure is going to collapse and you know it before anybody else does. Okay? This is especially possible in a permissive legal climate. It is said that one should not speak ill of the resigned, but I have often wondered how much different and better the Obama administration might have been if only Eric Holder had been alive. With that backdrop, let me offer and advance yet another framework, which my sometime collaborator from the wilds of northern British Columbia, Jing Chen, and I call a biophysical framework. Biophysical because it draws on basic principles from biological and physical realms, and because it actually attempts to respect the laws of thermodynamics. The basic principle is that large-scale economic systems achieve efficiency by making long-term investments that commit them to paying out fixed costs. And this is the source of successful economic development, essentially. But that larger systems are fragile, more fragile than smaller and less well-developed ones, because the margin of surplus depends on the cost of resources, notably on the energy return on investment. This is true of any functioning entity. It's true of animals. It's true of companies. It's true of machines. It's true of countries. And there are conditions when resource costs rise or when they are high, when a lower burden of fixed costs conveys advantages, a more profitable and sustainable system. This is, I think, just an elaboration of the observation about cash in and cash out that Paul Davidson reminded us of just an hour or so ago. It's essentially the same thing. You're committed to certain expenditures, some of which occur at money rates that you cannot predict and control, and you can operate only so long as those commitments are within the range of your revenues. So with this framework in mind, I think it's possible to divide the entire post-war period into, let's say, three major segments. The first one, 1945 until roughly 1970, was a period of low resource costs, the opening up of all kinds of new economic possibilities, economic growth practically for the entire world, with somewhat higher rates for the developing than for the developed countries, great expansion of trade, a stable, in many cases, actually more equalizing distribution of income. It's what the Mexican called the period of stabilizing development. And a growth theory that emerged out of Cambridge, Massachusetts in those days, which completely ignored the resource question, which was characterized by Bob Solow saying that the reason that if God had wanted three factors of production, he would have made it easier to draw three-dimensional diagrams. I ask my students, and you should ask yours, to go home at the end of that first day of production theory and bring you something made out of capital and labor. No resources, no materials can be used. Good luck with that. Okay, so that's the first segment, but it was something that you could get away with in this period up until 1970, when resource costs were considered to be a very trivial aspect of a larger picture. Then there was a decade of disruption and turbulence in which everybody got to know what OPEC was, what the oil price was, and Paul Davidson once again made a considerable impact on the world by virtue of the fact that he was one of the very few trained economists who knew anything about oil. And then from 1980 to 2000, we, at least in the rich countries, made a point of forgetting it all once again. There had been a failed effort, awkward in certain respects, to introduce resources into economics in the 1970s. It became kind of an allergic topic or a subfield of truly dedicated people, whose importance we now recognize. But from the early 1980s onward, the importance was once again obscured by very high financial flows from the poor countries to the rich, debt crises as a result, collapse of commodity prices, and therefore the return of low resource costs compounded by the collapse of the Soviet Union as empire and another wave of commodity dumping on the world economy, and therefore a world of uneven growth. And I've done a lot of work on inequality and a lot of work that has been basically oriented toward building up measures and information and data and trying to figure out what the picture was. And I think I understand it now in this period. The picture was in some ways very simply, at the world level, a picture of rising incomes in the richer countries and non-rising or falling incomes in the poorer ones and increasing inequality for that reason. It's straightforward. Also within countries, rising incomes for richer people, people who control capital assets, and falling incomes for people who didn't. So rising inequality was a consequence of the very different macroeconomic environment that continued up until 2000 and culminated in the great boom of the incomes of the richest of the rich, which was the finance sector and the information technology sector at that time. And then from 2000 onward, the world changed again. We returned, at least through 2008, to a period of unambiguously high resource costs. We had frantic efforts to maintain or to restore a growth rate, which it turned out couldn't be restored. Efforts that went through tax cuts in early Bush administration that were at least somewhat associated with the war in Iraq in 2003, with great public expenditures in 2004. And ultimately, with this phenomenon of looting on a colossal scale in real estate finance. Pouring money in, getting some construction and some consumption expenditures back, but on terms that were certain, that were timed to explode, timed to collapse by the 228 and 327 mortgages. You could tell when you were going to hit the point where you either had to refinance the speculative phase or you would discover that you were in Ponzi, and maybe that beyond Ponzi you would discover that the entire system had been looted to a fairly well, which turned out to be the case. And then the thing fell apart, as it will, when people who have unpayable financial obligations realize that this is the case. And so there was a panic and a massive collapse of activity. And now, how do we think of these things? Well, we continue to speak of them as though the system that seemed to be functioning for the 50-year period, if you omit the 70s and forget about them, from the end of the Second World War to the turn of the millennium, we're still functioning. We talk about potential growth, potential output. What is that? It is a projection of a trend built on the statistical record of a long period of time, on the underlying assumption that the structure generating that trend hasn't changed. We talk about the natural rate of unemployment, or the NARU. Well, we don't in this room, but lots of people do. And what is that? It is the assumption that certain conditions of the labor market are underlying reality, which will reassert themselves when the storm passes. By what mechanism of adjustment of real wages is never carefully explored, because it's not plausible. But there is an underlying assumption of normality associated with this. We even talk, some people even talk in the shade of Newt Fixell, of the natural rate of interest. Right? And so we're given to expect that there will be some return from the current zero on the managed rates to something approaching the historical pattern. We're not given a coherent explanation as to why that will happen or whether it can be made to happen without causing another massive financial disruption. Although we do recognize from time to time that when the Fed tries this, or even talks about trying it, or even hints about talking about trying it, that the disruptions are right there. So the return to normal recedes like a mirage, suggesting, if you've been paying attention for 6 years, that there might be something else at play, some barriers and limits, something beyond a simple failure to take the most aggressively Keynesian advice. Pseudo-vulgar Keynesian advice, to stimulate, a word which I heartily despise. And I suggest there are four such factors, at least, but there are four anyway that I felt were worth talking about, worth projecting in a book of this kind. The first is what I call the choke chain effect, which has to do not just with energy prices, but with their financialization. And with the fact that in a period when prices are rising, there are lots of ways to keep the oil in the ground, or slow down the tankers, or fill up the storage tanks, and sell it a little later at a higher price, hoping that you get in before everybody else does and the price collapses. $148 in 2008 was the key example of that. And that, of course, is a drain on current purchasing power of people who are buying that product, right, which contributes to their financial stresses. We've got some relief mitigation of that at God knows what environmental cost from fracking, right, which is clearly an advantage for this community of the United States as opposed to Europe, which doesn't have it. How long it will last, how much it will cost, remain questions that I think even the physicists, the geophysicists, don't have clear answers to. Second big issue, it seems to me, is that we really live in a much more unstable, and we're moving into a progressively more unstable world political environment, world security environment. The Cold War up through 1991 was relatively stable, mostly. You had two opposing systems which were in competition with each other, had a certain performance discipline, especially we did, and we lasted that pretty well. And then you had a system after that where we operated under the impression that the United States could provide security for a globalizing world, and a lot of globalization took place under that system. And then we actually tested the proposition that military power can restore stability in Iraq, an urban setting, Afghanistan, a mountainous rural one, and we discovered, and military professionals know this as well as anybody, that the ability to do so is extraordinarily limited. And there we are. The rest of the world can see this very clearly, does see it very clearly, recognizes that we're not going to be in a position to provide the same level of long-term confidence in the security of the world system that has existed for the last 60 years. And the third is this question of technological change. Hotly discussed and contested in economics, and I certainly have been, it was an early critic 20 years ago of the idea that it was technology that was behind the rising inequality in any skill-related sense. But it does seem to me clear that technological change changes the conditions in labor markets, and change that this type of technological change that we are living with today is quite different from the predominant mode in the 20th century. In the 20th century, we can talk about the transportation revolution, which replaced horses with motorized transport. Right? Veblen's great observation about trucks and the army in World War I, which was that invention is the mother of necessity. But when you look at that body of technological change, you had a lot of downstream employment that was created. Roads had to be built and maintained. Machinery had to be built and maintained. You have a whole spectrum of ancillary industries which created this large part of the service sector, and indeed patterns of life were changed in ways which created lots and lots of employment. Right? It wasn't, in fact, so good for one other previously employed population, namely the horses. Right? But we tend to forget about them. The digital revolution does not, so far as I can tell, create this massive downstream need for human employment. Right? And it reduces the requirements for manpower in the profit-making sector by substantial amounts. Now, it's true that the ratio of labor to capital hasn't changed very much, but that's because the capital has also become very cheap. And I think anybody who goes in is in an information-based industry, as we all are, including the deeply threatened professorate, knows that this is the case. But I'd give you just one other example that I like to use, which is the effect of these things on the air freight business between China and the United States. What's that effect? What obvious fact about smartphones is that they're very small. You can put an awful lot of them in a single airplane. So Federal Express's pilots and its equipment lie idle compared to what they were using before. Very simple. That sort of change is something that is ongoing and is contributing to the declining role of private profit-making employment in the economy. And the fourth major force that I discuss in the book is the dysfunction of the financial sector. An institutional failure. We've gone through a process in which we save financial institutions by greatly concentrating them, greatly increasing their presence in the economy and their political power, but without repairing their basic failure to provide the impetus for economic activity that creates jobs or serves social purposes. And here is where I think in a strong way depart company from the simple stimulus approach or the QE approach, the idea that if you give the banks money, they will have money to lend. Banks, as Minsky always said, are not money lenders. They don't need money in order to lend. But the basic metaphor I would use here is that we don't face a vehicle with a shortage of fuel. We have one with a melted transmission. Okay? Adding fuel to such a car is not going to make it run. Entirely straightforward. Whether the vehicle can be repaired at all, given the damage already done to it, seems to me, at this stage, given the politics and some of the complexities of actually regulating institutions of this scale, an open question. I'm not sure that can be repaired. I don't think we're making significant progress. And so that strikes me as an enormous fixed cost, which we continue to pay, and which acts as a burden on every other form of business, including the businesses that we really need to serve purposes that we actually have. Therefore, it is both structural and financial. I conflate the two in that sector. Finally, I have the word here, wither, with an H. What does this imply? If I'm right about these things, what does it imply for what we should be doing, what should we should be thinking about going forward. I'll just make a few very quick points and then I'll wrap it up. First is that the value of social insurance programs under these conditions goes up, not down. And that it's very clear if you compare the United States to Europe that a saving grace in this country is the fact that the institutions that were created in the 20th century and the Great Society and in the New Deal continued by and large to function and greatly increased payments in the immediate crisis all across the country, cushioning a large share of the population from its direct income loss. Couldn't cushion them from the loss of their retirement accounts or their value of their houses, but you could replace the lost incomes, and a lot of it was in fact replaced, which was not the case in Greece or Portugal or Ireland, where austerity meant that the very weak programs that already existed had to be cut in the crisis. Very big difference, and greatly, I think, emphasizes the importance of mounting a political defense of Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, unemployment insurance, the whole spectrum of core social insurance programs that were established in the Depression and in the post-war period. Second point is that I think this whole story emphasizes the need for standards, and standards are an essential feature of a modern economy. Standards for wages, I'm in favor of a major increase in the minimum wage. Standards for working conditions, standards for the environment, standards for the financial sector. We just have to face the fact that this whole debate over getting government out of the economy was a formula for producing disaster and regression. And we have to be clear that that claim has to be met head on and countered repeatedly. Third point is that without a private sector self-confident enough to undertake long-term investment, then the public sector or stable institutions, nonprofit institutions, have to do that work, appropriate to the conditions and aimed particularly at providing common consumption goods that can enhance living standards in a way that is shared broadly in the population and done very efficiently. This is, gets back to the question of social balance that my father wrote about in 1958, of private affluence and public squalor. Fourth, we clearly need jobs that can't be digitized. I'm very proud of my son who's become a cook. It's very sensible. People will always need to eat. But beyond that, there are vast areas where we have unmet needs. Unmet needs as far as our living structures, as far as the environment, but especially as far as caring for fellow citizens are concerned. And we need to have institutions that can employ people to do those things and to do them in a useful and straightforward way. To provide home care, for example, which we presently don't do, for the elderly. Right? You could employ a great many people in that kind of work, and that's work which can be professional and cannot be converted into the work of an information processing machine. And then finally, I would suggest that we need urgently to get economists like myself off the stage and to bring into these forums people who have done a deep study and can speak effectively to the question of what we actually should do to meet the challenge of climate change. Because if we don't do that, good luck to us all and to our descendants. Thank you very much indeed.